This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Later this hour, we meet travel writer and former New York Times The Frugal Traveler columnist Seth Krugel to explore his new book, Rediscovering Travel, A Guide for the Globally Curious. And before that, we'll speak with founding member of the appropriationist art collective Negative Land, Mark Hostler, ahead of his experimental sound concert experience event that's coming Saturday evening at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery at South Florida Southwestern State College. The performance is part of his currently running slow-motion solo tour of the USA. But first, we're delving into the gallery's currently running exhibition and interactive installation titled Gorilla Girls, Rattling Cages Since 1985. The exhibition highlights the history and work of the Gorilla Girls Feminist Advocacy and Art Collective. For more than three decades, members of the group have been working anonymously to expose practices that continue to keep women, people of color, and other marginalized groups out of the mainstream art world. Joining me in studio for a closer look at the exhibition is Bob Rauschenberg, Gallery Director Jade Dellinger. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live, Jade.
Thanks so much, John. Pleasure to be here.
And joining us by phone is a longtime member of the Gorilla Girls. We're speaking with a member who goes by the code name or call sign, I'm not sure the exact way to put it, but of Frida Kahlo, and that's naturally in honor of the painter. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us today, Frida. It's an honor to speak with you.
Hi, great to be with you too.
And as always, we invite listeners to join the conversation. The phone number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. And Frida, to start us off, I was hoping you could just expound a bit on the brief description I just gave on what the Gorilla Girls are all about.
Well, in 1985, the Museum of Modern Art had an exhibition that they said was an international survey of painting and sculpture. There were 169 artists in it, only 13 women and only 8 artists of color. And we got kind of pissed off about that. No one seemed to think that there was any kind of discrimination at work behind those figures. So we decided then and there that we were going to figure out some provocative, in-your-face, outrageous, unforgettable way of proving that to people.
And have you been part of the movement since the beginning, it sounds like?
Yes, I'm a lifer.
Oh, a lifer. And, you know, the name of the group is a homonym, with gorilla, of course, referring to the, you know, resistance fighter definition, not the mammal. But, of course, you become synonymous with those gorilla animal masks. And I was hoping you could tell me about how that came about, because I understand it was a bit of an accident at first.
Well, you know, we just were angry, and we passed around a hat, had enough money to do some posters, so we put the posters up on the street. And to our great surprise, amazement, and delight, we were like an overnight topic. Everyone was talking not so much about us, but about the issues. And very quickly, we had requests for publicity. So we had to come up with some kind of a disguise. And, I mean, the crazy story is that one of our members was a really bad speller, and she was taking notes, and she misspelled the word guerrilla, you know, the freedom fighter.
Yes.
Gorilla. And in the middle of the discussion, we realized, wow, that is a message from, you know, from all the neglected women artists in history. We should wear gorilla masks while we wear gorillas.
And in terms of the need for anonymity, who are the Gorilla Girls? Because you have to be plugged into the art world, I guess, to even start to see and start to want to change these systemic problems and these issues of parity when it comes to marginalized groups. I mean, are you artists, museum curators, art critics, all the above?
Well, we're all arts professionals in one way or another. And over the years, more than 60 people have been in and out of our group, and we've been diverse in as many ways as you can imagine. So we are a kind of fluid group. Some people stay for decades, some people stay for months, and some can only bear to be around us for one single meeting.
Okay.
We're kind of bossy.
Got it. Well, thinking back on the group's long history, can you tell me about, you know, some of the street projects or poster campaigns that you've been involved with that I guess maybe you recall most fondly or that you think were particularly effective?
Well, everything has kind of grown. We used to put the posters up in the streets of New York around where the galleries were, and then we could go out, you know, we put them up at night, we'd go out the next day, and we'd hang around the posters and listen to what people would say, and it would give us ideas for new posters. So the posters kind of evolved. You know, we started pointing fingers at all of the cross section, all the parts, all the filters in the art world who said it was someone else's fault. We fingered, you know, white male artists, to allow their work to be shown in galleries that weren't diverse. Then we went after the galleries that weren't diverse. Then we went after critics. Then we went after museum curators. We made sure that no one could really pass the buck to someone else. Then we started to ask some other questions, like, do women have to be naked to get into the Metropolitan Museum, where we counted the naked females in the artwork versus the number of women artists in the collection. And that became, you know, one of our most iconic pieces. Then we did The Advantages of Being a Woman Artist, which is really a reverse of the disadvantages. We sort of told the disadvantages as advantages. And with the dawn of the Internet, we had a very early website and very early Facebook page. We've since then done books, billboards, animations. You know, our website is very, very active. We've done interactive projects where we ask the public to contribute, like we did at the Rauschenberg. And one thing has just led to another, and the situation evolves, so do we.
This what I notice a lot of is this sort of journalistic aesthetic to a lot of the informational posters that you do, because, I mean, it's researched and data-driven. Has that been a part of it since the beginning?
We like to call it the subversive use of information. What we realize is if you can say something outrageous to get someone's attention, and then you back it up with some facts, well, once you get someone who disagrees with you to laugh a little bit, then you have a hook inside their brain, and if you slam them with the information, it sort of proves your point.
All right. And this is a question for both of you, Frida and Jade. But I was listening to Florida Southwestern State College Professor Wendy Chase's lecture at the opening. Also, that's great. I would recommend anybody go to YouTube and find that if you want to learn more. She describes the art market as one of the largest unregulated markets in the world. And just talking about how it's kind of difficult to identify any kind of overarching system that would even enable an ability to assign an objective monetary value to art. Who really controls the art world? Ultimately, who are the tastemakers?
Frida?
Oh, Jade, do you have an idea about that?
I'm afraid not, and I've been in it for, you know, 30 years. There are institutions with power and with money, and many collectors who feed those institutions and who are on boards of directors with various institutions. And so, in some ways, the Rauschenberg Gallery, in that we're, you know, based at a state college, and we do not have a board, but we, you know, of course, we have to have exhibitions funded and that sort of thing. We have a great deal of freedom to be doing these kinds of projects. And for me, in terms of the invitation that we were able to extend to the Guerrilla Girls, it was such an honor to be able to work with them. But it's also this year, 2019, our 40th anniversary. And I must say, I was looking back at our history and both feeling as if we have not done enough and that it should be a question that we continue to ask about who we're representing through the gallery. Of course, we have a deceased white male artist who is on our door in terms of our gallery name, but I was just thrilled that the Guerrilla Girls were open to this. And for us, it was about being a little self-reflective during this time, our 40th anniversary. They proposed this idea of a survey of their poster projects, better known and most recent. And then I sort of insisted that we do a complaint room, which is something they've done in the past.
But That's the interactive element there. Okay.
Yeah, so that people could actually come in and complain about us or complain about, you know, their lot in the art world or within whatever the context they choose. So people are actually coming in and writing their complaints directly on our walls.
Interesting. All right. And Frida, I can completely understand why, you know, initially the need for anonymity was so important. But do you ever foresee a day when for the Guerrilla Girls that might not be the case?
Well, anonymity has such an important role in American history, in particular American Revolution. You can depersonalize an issue when you're anonymous, and so you can really focus on what the problem is. The minute you know who I am, you'll look into my life, and you might think that you might try to undermine, you know, the issues that I'm presenting that are more issues that are socially driven. So I don't think anyone cares who we are anymore. I think our anonymity is essential for our ability to speak truth to power. So I don't think that's even an issue anymore. It is kind of bad to have a whole life under a pseudonym and to have people recognize you with your gorilla mask but not in your real face. But, you know, that's just, you know, that's just part of the deal.
Got it. Gotcha. You know, I was also going back to the opening night lecture series, and of course, Frieda was part of that as well. Jade, you had talked about a particular book that probably has passed through the hands of every art student studying at the collegiate level and sort of lamenting the lack of female minority representation in it. Yeah. And I was sort of contrasting that with my own college experience. I didn't study art, but I remember taking a mass communication class. And Frieda, we had a whole section on the Guerrilla Girls. So I'm wondering if you feel like, you know, we're seeing tangible progress.
Yes, you know, things have changed. When we started, curators and critics and dealers and collectors would say that they couldn't find any art by women and artists of color, and that was just the way it was in the history of Western art. No one would say that anymore. No one would dare think that you could write the history of a culture without including all the diverse voices of the culture in that history. So that's a great advance. However, if you look at the art world now, and it's run by billionaires, it's run by big money and mostly white men, collectors, that's a little disturbing. That's something that we didn't understand. You know, the museums are run by, you know, by wealthy collectors on their boards, and that's one argument why it's an unregulated market. You know, when an art collector has an art collection and then is sitting on the press, you know, the board of a museum that's making decisions about what art to show and acquire, well, isn't that a bit of a conflict of interest? You know, the age of kings and queens and emperors deciding what our history is over. We live in a democratic time. We've really got to get the art market out of the institutions of art museums.
Well, Frieda, it sounds like the context you just described would make it really difficult for, you know, even curators in some of these well-established galleries who want to do something different. Like, it seems like that aspect, the financial aspect, would even limit what they can do.
Well, why not make cheap art? Why not make art for everyone? That's happened a lot in the history of Western art. That's what prints and printmaking was all about. It was about making things accessible. Anyone with $20 can buy one of our posters and have them in their house. I think there are lots of ways of monetizing art that artists have not thought of. The easiest thing to do is to make precious objects for rich people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's kind of appropriate that you bring that up. The last time I think Jade connected and I was on a Steve Keen exhibition, and that's, mm-hmm. you know, while he's not a woman, of course, that's what his work seems to be all about as well. Frieda, what's next for the Guerrilla Girls? Are there any upcoming endeavors our listeners should be on the lookout for?
We're working on some publishing issues. We have a new project coming out that's exactly about museums. We're rewriting our code of ethics for art museums, which we wrote back in the 90s, and we're updating it a little bit to talk about how some wealthy entrepreneurs actually use museums to launder their images. Such as the Koch brothers, and how museums and cultural institutions allow them to do that.
Wow, interesting. And Jade, I have to ask you, because I noticed that this is a site-specific installation, so that kind of gives me the impression this isn't going to pack up and go somewhere else when it's done here. This seems like something you really did want to bring specifically to Southwest Florida.
Well, the marvelous thing about the Gorilla Girls idea here was actually just to essentially send everything in digital form. So so we were given opportunity to, you know, propose a layout for the exhibition, and, you know, they did some new graphic design in terms of signage and that sort of thing for us specifically. But it really, as they continue to travel these exhibitions, they are able to do so by, you know, when originally done, many of these were rather small in terms of format with these posters, you know, and here we can have the option to sort of blow them up and make them very immersive and confrontational sort of experiences as visitors come into the gallery. So we did that, and we were in constant communication as the project was coming together, and we adjusted a bit the checklist. So we included a work that really hasn't been shown much, which is one of their most recent ones that has to do with museum labels and sexual predators. And I think it's here and done, but at the same time, they'll certainly continue to be making many exhibitions and sending their imagery to be dealt with by institutions moving forward.
Yeah. And
it's so exciting, if I could just say.
Absolutely.
In here. It's so exciting to see how other people, other curators, install our work. And it's never the same. It's always personalized. And it also pulls them into our conspiracy. So we're just thrilled. That's the way.
Well, and I wanted to go back to Professor Dr. Wendy Chase's lecture. I was so riveted by it because, you know, part of the way that it was formatted was she would just spend a few, and she talked for nearly an hour, she would just spend a few minutes talking about different women artists who were just incredible talents. And this goes all the way back to, like, medieval times, like the women who sewed the Bayeux Tapestry, all the way up through women who were living and producing in the 20th century. And I had only ever recognized one of them, and that was the artist that your call sign is named for, Frida. And to me, that really set home the concept that even in education, you know, in art educations, which you think would be more, I guess, liberal-minded, there just seems to be this marginalization of women artists. Even the way they were, you know, the way they were described in their own times, if they were really good, was, oh, she paints like a man. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of like the only way they could be defined.
Well, even
well, you know, art isn't immune from all of the prejudices and biases in the culture at large.
Right.
And for the longest time, you know, women artists were well, it wasn't even considered that a woman could be an artist, that the category of being an artist, of being a genius, of making masterpieces was just not something that women were capable of. And we know that that's not true. And even the few artists like Artemisia Gentileschi or Sofonisba Anguissola or Rosa Bonheur in the 19th century, even the artists who did figure out some way in their own life to be productive and to be recognized, art historians at the end of the 19th century wrote them out of the history. So it was a double whammy. Not only did they break the rules in their lifetime, they broke the rules of history.
Interesting.
Even when I was a student in the mid-80s, the text, as you talked about earlier, you know, Janssen's History of Art included zero women. And more recent editions, it's been translated into 15 languages and millions of copies have been sold. But even more recent editions, where there are 300-plus artists represented, have less than 30 women listed.
Yeah. Frida, I want to ask a little more about the group. Like at any given time, about how many members would you say there are? And do you find that you're all maybe centrally located in a particular city, or are you all over the country, all over the world?
Well, we used to all be in the same city, but, you know, people's lives changed and technology evolved. So, you know, we went from fax machines to, you know, to computers, to the internet, to whatever. So we are now scattered all over, and our group is very fluid because we have no rules of membership. And everyone's life changes, and we have to realize that. So, I don't know. I think your fantasy about how large we are is probably more interesting than the reality.
Okay. Then let's go with that. and I heard you describe in sort of the Skype Q&A during the opening last week, you had described, someone asked you what it's like to be a gorilla girl, and I think your answer was something to the effect of, I imagine being married to 50 different people for 30 years. Can you say more about that? I mean, you must be a pretty tightly knit group.
Well, you know, to collaborate is a very unique and special thing, and it needs a certain kind of formula or recipe of personalities and communication styles. But this is all complicated by the fact that artists are not really trained to work collectively. They're trained to be individuals. That is the sort of Western stereotype of the artist as an angry, irascible, slightly crazy, and usually white male. Mm. So we decided we wanted that, you know, five heads were better than one, and that we would work collectively. And we had to really figure that out. It's not easy. It is messy. But once it works, it's really terrific.
And Frida, of course, I want to respect your anonymity, but maybe without revealing too much, can you tell us what maybe your specific connection to the art world is? Or do you consider yourself an artist? Do you work in a museum?
Yeah, I am an artist. I'm an artist, and I also consider myself an activist. We've been doing activist art for a long time before there was even a word for it. When we first started out in 1980, it was really thought that you couldn't be an artist and an activist at the same time. That, you know, somehow the formal structure of art meant that you couldn't deal with politics. But that was really short-sighted. And now there are many, many words terms to describe what activist artists do: social practice, art activists, institutional critique, culture jammer, you know, all those terms have sort of sprung up to describe work like what we do, and which is now, you know, assumed to be just part of what artists do.
If somebody wanted to join the movement, what would be the best way? Should they just, because I know you guys have a website, would maybe that be the best way to get in touch and find out how you can start contributing yourself?
Well, the best way people can do work like we do is to form their own group. The world needs more feminist activist groups rather than just the Gorilla Girls. Otherwise, we would just be an employment agency.
Gotcha.
And we say, need us. Just, you know, use us as a model and go and make up your own crazy name and do your own crazy stuff.
All right. And in your experience, are there currently or have there ever been any male Gorilla Girls?
No. Well, you know, it hasn't been easy to find guys who are willing to work for no credit and no money. So I would say it's been hard to find, men who would like to do that, but we're always open. And we know the world is changing, so why not?
All right. And Frida, I know that aside from, this current site-specific exhibition with us here in Southwest Florida, there's currently a traveling Gorilla Girls exhibition as well. Could you maybe tell us a little about that?
Well, that's the wonderful thing about our digital show, is it can be in 10 different places at the same time. So right now we've got a show going up in Auckland, New Zealand. We have a show that's currently up in Sweden. We have a lot of work in the permanent collection rehang at Tate Modern in London. We're negotiating with some colleges and universities in the United States, Bucknell being one. Our work was in Hanover, Germany. We've had retrospectives in Spain, in Bilbao, and Madrid, several retrospectives done exactly the same way digitally in France. So that's the wonderful thing about doing cheap art, you know, art that can be digitally reproduced, is that we can just send the images and the institution can make a lot of decisions about the scale and the placement and the selection. It's pretty wonderful, actually. It's great to know that we can be everywhere all the time.
All right. Well, the exhibit and interactive exhibition, Gorilla Girls, Rattling Cages Since 1985, is currently running at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery at Florida Southwestern State College, and that'll be there through March 23rd. And Frida Kahlo of the Gorilla Girls, thanks again for taking the time to speak with us. It's been such an honor.
Thank you. It's been great with you, being with you too. Hey, Jay, bye.
Bye. Thanks, Frida.
And we do just have a few minutes left. We were looking to talk about a concert coming up this Saturday evening at the gallery by Mark Hosler, a founding member of the renowned experimental music band and audiovisual collage group Negative Land. And that's going to be a solo performance by Mark Hosler. We haven't been able to get him on the phone. So just for a minute, Jade, I was hoping you could give us a bit of a preview about what this concert performance experience is really going to be all about.
Certainly. Well, yeah, it's interesting. Speaking of collectives and of culture jamming, Negative Land really coined the term culture jamming. And they are a collective of sonic artists, really, but sort of better known ultimately for a lawsuit that ensued after their release of an album that they titled U2. It was an EP. Just before U2 was releasing their own album. But Mark Hosler, who's a founding member of that group since 1980, is doing what he's calling the slow motion solo tour. He's actually driving his Subaru around the Southeast at the moment, coming up from Miami. He's playing there tonight. And Mark is going to be doing sort of experimental sound noise concert. We're going to have as an opener Sonic Combine, sort of our house band, all former collaborators of Bob Rauschenberg, and Lily and David Hatchett are doing a paper grotto. But Mark's work is really based on all of these sort of circuit bent devices and what was called the Booper, which is actually a little device that Negative Land had come up with and regularly performed with. So it should be a rather improvisational sort of new music event.
All right. So Mark's in Miami now. I know that you got to see his recent performance on another leg of this tour at the Palladium in St. Petersburg. Is there going to be a visual element to this as well as Negative Land is wont to do?
Absolutely. Yeah. He's brought a simple sort of stage set. But that said, he'll also be playing in front of Lily and David Hatchett's Paper Grotto. So that is in and of itself a sort of immersive visual experience with projection and sort of white paper objects behind. So that will be very much a part of the set. In addition to that, yeah, he has, a few lighting effects and some other things like that. But and we'll come and sort of set up the sound for the room. At the Palladium, it was like that too. There's no otherwise opening act that's touring with him. He's picked up local acts in each venue. And again, tonight, I think he's at Churchill's on Saturday from 7 to 9. He'll be with us. And he had been here once before, so this is sort of a triumphant return. He gave his keynote lecture, Adventures in Illegal Art, as part of our 2016 Humanities Colloquium. I first met Mark when Negative Land was on tour about 20 years ago. We've been in constant contact. And so it's just a thrill, actually, to have him in Southwest Florida performing for the first time on this tour.
Well, sounds like it's going to be a great and very unique and free concert experience, I should remind folks. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us. Jade, he's the director of the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery at Florida Southwestern State College. Jade Delegar, as always, it's great to speak with you. And again, that concert that we've just been speaking about is going to be Saturday night at 7 o'clock at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery at Florida Southwestern State College, where you can also check out the currently on exhibit exhibition about the Guerrilla Girls. And earlier in the show, we were speaking with one of the Guerrilla Girls herself, Frida Kahlo. I'm John Davis, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. We're taking a short break, but when we return, WGCU's Julie Glenn sits down with travel writer Seth Kugel to discuss his new book, Rediscovering Travel, A Guide for the Globally Curious. Stay with us.